Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charles Hyde. I am a research professor at the world's most southerly university, the University of Otago in New Zealand. The fact that I've gone almost completely grey reflects the last 20 minutes of the last World Cup. extremely tense. I don't know whether Eric suggested that I went to New Zealand because it was about as far as he could send me from Cambridge, but that's where I went in 1966. And so my experience of Eric Higgs essentially began in 1959 when I matriculated at St. Catharines, and it ended on about the 10th of December 1966 when my wife and my little son Thomas, aged 10 months, left Tilbury for a 5-week voyage to New Zealand. As an undergraduate, of course, I got to know Eric. I want to give you some slight flavour, perhaps slightly also exaggerated, but it was like then, in 59-60, to be an undergraduate learning archaeology. I was a precise contemporary of John Landry sitting in front of me, Colin Renfrew, Barry Cunliffe, and Paul Mellers. And we were taught by Graham Clark, by Dean Daniel, and by John Coles, and if you did, Perifick, by Charles McBurney. Typically, one would sit in the South Lecture Theatre wearing one's gown, and when the lecturer swept in, or the professor swept in wearing an MA gown, one stood up and was then invited to sit down. And then we were regaled with Graham's latest information on the Mesolithic of Scandinavia, which never turned me on particularly. Glyn Daniel would come in and announce another radiocarbon date, which was transforming our knowledge, of course, of the chronology, albeit without any form of calibration. And it helped if you were doing the Bronze Age, if you knew the difference between hashtag B2 and B3 on the basis of where the sword had its mission stood. Now, as I thought at the time, I'm much more interested in who was wielding the sword and rather than the shape of the hilt. And so when I was confronted by Eric Higgs, it seemed to me like a new world. I'd come up to Cambridge having spent 2 years at the Institute of Archaeology in London and there learning Roman archaeology, and I excavated with a very distinguished professor at the Roman site. I'm not going to mention the name or site because the point of this particular saga is that animal bones are simply thrown away. In fact, every afternoon at 4:30 at this particular site, a car was driven home by a bloke and shout out at this, "Got me old bones!" So we accumulated them and threw them at him. So to be told by Eric Higgs in one of his famous aphorisms to me, "Hi," he'd say, "I can tell you more about a prehistoric society in one bone than from a suitcase of hand axes." It certainly attracted my juvenile attention. Now, in preparing for this art session, and I have to acknowledge that with grateful thanks, the organisation of Pamela Jane in inviting me and in organising so well, I referred back to my 1962 diary and I found myself saying things about Eric. And there were revelations to me 40 years later. I can't get my glasses on so I can read it. 1962, when I was in my third year, and I have to tell you that the atmosphere in 1962 in the department as an undergraduate was red hot. One first was often given, sometimes no firsts, and this was your place in the sun if you got one. And so Eric used to play you off. He used to speak to you very quietly and say, "Graham's been very hard at Renfrew, you know. He's doing very well, Renfrew." Or, "Graham's going hot on Barry, you know. Did you know how well he's doing?" And you say, "God, what about me?" And so in 1962, on the 24th of January, in my diary, I wrote, "I had an hour and a half with Eric Higgs identifying animal bones. He really is a marvellous man, so full of, so kind and full of sympathy." And that's what I felt about him. And he had these piercing blue eyes, and he would look at you and talk to you as if you were the only one in the world who mattered. It probably was the same impression given to every analyst and everyone else who had something to do with Eric, but he made me feel as if I was really important. And if he had a bunch of animal bones from the side, he'd say, "Hi, why don't you look at those and publish them?" Me publish something, for goodness sake. So naturally, when he said, Hi, sometimes he called me Hi, and sometimes he called me Chaz. Hi, and he said, I want you to come to Greece. And so I joined him on his first expedition to Greece to look for Neanderthal man. We left in two Land Rovers, and I, with David Calvo Caressi and Rhys Jones, sat in the back of Land Rover for a week as Eric drove us down to Greece. And in the back too, or sometimes I think in the front, was Marion, his wife, who was taken along as the cook. And there was another Land Rover as well, owned by a friend of Eric's, and so we had two Rovers. And as I say, I have my diaries of that initial fieldwork campaign. I had with me too a movie camera and a lot of Agfa coloured film. And I took about 3 hours of movie film of that summer in Greece, and it's lost. I wish someday it may have turned up in some dusty attic somewhere, but it's lost. Now, we drove down, as I say, to Greece. I said on the Greece cover, I fell in love with a girl in Maribor. We crossed the border. I was sitting in the back after 2 days sitting there, and she was in a uniform. She was a border guard in the Yugoslavia. I shall never forget her. And she became a speck on the horizon. And so down we went, and I have a note here. Yes, we are here to find the Neanderthals, and after 16 hours at the wheel, finally we reached Greece. And I wrote on the 8th of July, and that we arrived in Greece on the 1st of July, 62, 8th of July, just had a great evening meal. Can you imagine that? Marion was there, she gave us a great evening meal on the primes. Camped beside a lake so blue and beautiful, it was like a fairy tale. 17th July. Now in a lovely woody and green camping ground near Grevena, another super day. Eric's technique, of course, was because he wasn't particularly mobile, was to stop if he saw, I think he must have a hidden agenda. He never discussed his fieldwork techniques with me. When I look for sites, I always ask the locals, because they live there all their lives. Eric, if he saw a Greek, would drive in the opposite direction. And so he must have had an agenda, I'm not sure what it was, but he just drove around and he'd stop when he wanted a cigarette. And or when he saw something that was likely, we were his running dogs, he'd say, hi, go and look up there. And then, and I kid you not, he wore a very short, very brief pair of underpants. And that's all. And down the front, he had his cigarettes. And he said, hi, go. And he fished down the front, and pulled out a cigarette, and lighted it. And wait for your return. And we found all those sites that have nothing to do with the Neanderthal. And so I said on another occasion, where are we? Today has been wildly successful in 2030, finding no less than 8 sites, but they were all too late. They were not mysterious, clearly. And then the great day came. On the 1st of August, on the 31st of July, at last, a most significant day as we found a prolific mysterious industry in an eroded land surface. We're all really delighted over our Neanderthal discovery. How was it found? I don't know how many people know this as a fact, but I'll tell you how we found it. We had been, as I say, driving around northern Greece, finding some late Bronze Age or some Neolithic sites. And Eric thought, there's nothing here. We're going to Arta, he said, we're going to Arta. Hop in there. So we drove all day down to Arta. And it was quite a long way. About midday, there were some roadworks. And in the roadworks was a red light. And in the back was David Calvo Caressi, who spoke Greek. And we stopped at the red light. If it had been green, I promise you, you guys who dug those new streets, you probably never have gone because you wouldn't have found the site. The light was red. And Calvo looked out at the back of the Greek road worker and said, Ekete Skiliago. And he came around here. Neh, neh, said the guy. Over there. And so Calvo said, Eric, apparently there's some caves over there. Shall we stop and have a look? Eric said, well, I suppose it's lunchtime. Okay. And so he said, the running dogs, I went that way. And the other two, Rhys and Calvo, went that way. I came back with nothing. And stood there waiting with Eric beside the rover. 5 minutes later, around the corner came Rhys Jones with his big, broad hat off, and Calvo, who were each wearing a seraphic grin. And they got closer and closer. And they came up to Eric. And Eric, I'll never forget looking on his face. I was watching him and looking into the And I looked down and I saw these fantastic white Mousterian artifacts. And Eric looked at them and he picked one up, studied it, put it down and said, I think we'll stay here for a bit. And that's what happened. Now, I haven't got time to tell you the aftermath. It was an incredible 48 hours. But one day I'll write it down. It's in my diary anyway. So we returned to Cambridge full of triumph. We got the Neanderthal man and I was to do a PhD. And he became my PhD supervisor and I became, I believe, his first PhD student. And I went to see Eric for what I would imagine being my first supervision. And I said, Eric, yes, here I am now with a Stead scholarship. What do you think I should do? And his reply was, try Norway. So I went out and bought a Norwegian dictionary and ended up in Switzerland. And a bit in Denmark too. And I can tell you that Eric, I've got a little note here, I looked it up. Brian Fagan, who I first met in the Bone Room, Brian Fagan said, he forced us to think. Something few undergraduates get a chance to do. And he did, he forced me to think. And so I set off to do my PhD research, and Eric, as a PhD supervisor, gave me one supervision. And I'm not exaggerating, I had one supervision. I was pedaling home, I lived in Canton Street too, and he was coming from Japan in his Rover. We stopped at Outland Tennis Court Road. I'd given him the draft of my PhD thesis. He hauled me down in his Rover, pulled out the window. Hi, I'm Mr. I've read your dissertation. Careful how you use the word random and drove off. Everyone here on the panel will tell you that Higgs shaped your archaeological career. He was my archaeological father figure. Colin had been Daniel, Barry had been Daniel as their patrons, as it were, who got Colin into Sheffield and Barry into Southampton. Off they went, John into London. That was Greg Clark, I believe, Greg John into London. But where did I go? Because when I had an interview for a job in Birmingham, the professor Fred Shotton, FRS, the chairman of the interview panel, as I sat down for a job interview, said, ah, hi, I miss it. I've been looking for some, I'm wondering for some time where you chose such an eccentric PhD topic. I said, well, I think it's eccentric. And he said, well, I do. And so I ended up not in Birmingham, but in New Zealand. I went to see Eric. Eric, I said, what else shall I do? I've got a wife and a little 10-month-old baby. He said, write to Gallicol in Dunedin and Gulston in Australia. So I wrote to Peter Gallicol. I didn't want to go to Australia for some reason. Ended up in New Zealand. Arrived in January 67. And the first thing I did was to set up a phone room. And the first thing I did in Thailand when I got there 2 years later was to start collecting a comparative collection. And so, in terms of the impact of Eric on me, I became, as it were, almost, I don't flatter myself and call myself his clone, but I certainly followed a lot of his lines and have been doing so, and looking back, again, through my diaries and my memories, acknowledged the extraordinary impact that that luminous, charismatic, blue-eyed, gimlet-eyed man had on me and many others.